In 1908, the future of Morocco was not conquered, it was negotiated. In fact, the poor decisions made by the Sultan had been turning Moroccan sovereignty into a long-gone myth for quite some time now. This monarch, who was barely out of adolescence when the crown was bestowed upon him, was signing away yet another customs post to satisfy a loan that was negotiated in Paris. Meanwhile, outside the palace walls, the rumors had been going feral. The Sultan sold the country for a bicycle. A joke, perhaps, but one that was so deeply rooted into reality that it didn't make anyone laugh. Meanwhile, down south, another claimant to the throne was waiting for his turn to come. The Sultan's older brother. Same blood, different ambitions, and drastically different tempers. This descendant of the Alawi dynasty was no idealist, nor was he a fool like his brother back in Fez. Residing in his palace in Marrakech, he knows that the French are coming for the Moroccan reins of power, whatever that ends up looking like. They had been for a while, it was inevitable. So he sits and prepares. The only thing this offspring of the Alawi dynasty cares about is making sure that when it comes, colonization knocks on his door first, not his brother's. And in between these two visions of sovereignty lies a country that was fraying at every seam, torn between rebellions in different regions like the Rif, the Sousse, and Atlas Mutawassit. At the same time, Sufi orders were rallying their own followers a bit everywhere. Ports on the Mediterranean coast, for example, were being turned into quote-unquote zones of influence by foreign powers like a half-eaten cake at some sort of European banquet. The Mkhzin, this ancient machinery of Moroccan rule, was collapsing under the weight of telegrams. In the first few years of the 20th century, the question in Morocco was not whether the protectorate would come. It was more a matter of who was gonna sign the papers. This is the story of Al-Hafidhiya, the one last dance of dynastic sovereignty before the curtain fell before the eyes of the world, only to reveal how broken the Moroccan Sultanate had been for decades now. It is also the story of two brothers, Moulay Abdelaziz, the modernizer without a base, and Moulay Abdelhafid, the schemer who rode to power on the fake promise of jihad against Europe and ended up handing Morocco over to the very powers he had vowed to fight, the last momentum before the country became a French protectorate in 1912. And it is this deafening silence covering for a palace coup and a civil war, Morocco's fall from within and without, that we're gonna study today. Welcome back, history enthusiasts, to Tariq Nadab, the podcast where we explore Morocco's millennia-old heritage through sourced stories. I'm your host, Aya, and your traveling guide back in time for the next couple minutes. So, grab my hand, hold on to it real tight, and let's begin. To understand how Morocco eventually slipped into French control in 1912, we need to take a few deliberate steps back. Nearly two decades, in fact, to one pivotal year of Moroccan history. 1894. This year marked the death of Sultan Hassan al-Loul, Hassan I, while he was fighting an Amazigh tribe in their territory in Tadla. With his death, the delicate political balance that had been holding the Sultanate together in the face of a growing European pressure completely collapsed. The rule of Hassan al-Loul had been one of great political strategy. Unlike other rulers, he understood that the last few years of the 19th century were a turning point in human history, that the world was increasingly becoming a globalized one, with colonization being such a thing everywhere, and that therefore Morocco could not isolate itself. But he also knew that opening the gates too wide could eventually drown the country under the insatiable tide of European ambition. Hassan al-Loul ruled with a very rare mix of pragmatism and pride to preserve and protect his line's sovereignty, all while watching neighboring tribes in present-day Algeria losing theirs. So he walked. He walked a very, very careful line, almost impossible to cross. He accepted to take European advisors in some sectors. He encouraged selective technological imports. He opened limited trade routes, just enough to modernize the armor of the state and its military, but never so much that foreign powers could claim a foothold in Morocco. And for the couple years he was in power, it worked. A policy of measured openness or calculated restraint, depending on the perspective, shielding the country and gently nudging it forward, trying to save Morocco from the fate that had already consumed neighboring territories. And so when Hassan el-Loul died, the balance died with him. The vision for Morocco's future did not outlive the monarch. What remained was a vacuum that foreign interests were naturally too ready to exploit. As history put it, his son and chosen successor was Abdelaziz. Born in 1878, he was just 16 when he ascended to the throne of Morocco. A man that was frankly far too young to navigate these waters. So, naturally, who stepped in? A regent. Power was placed elsewhere during the early years of his reign and remained comfortably there for a while, in the hands of the man who made sure the young sultan was not sidelined by his brothers, claimants to the throne, when their father died, so he could secure his own regency. Ladies and gentlemen, Bouhmed. I've made an entire separate video on him on Instagram if you want to check it out. But what you need to know is that this guy was a seasoned chamberlain who was no visionary whatsoever, let's put it that way, but who understood exceptionally well the internal mechanics of Moroccan power, the invisible strings that were holding the structure of this crumbling mkhzin together. And by that I mean tribal alliances, pacts with religious authorities, etc., etc. For a couple years, Bouhmed managed to keep this illusion of continuity that was growing increasingly thin. But by their nature, illusions are fragile, fickle, and humans, at the end of the day, are mortals. So when Bouhmed died in 1900, that quiet stability vanished almost overnight. Moulay Abdelaziz was now in his early 20s, and so he could, and he had to, take the reins himself. And what followed wasn't so much a reign, to be honest, as much as it was an open-air surgery on the dying body of the Moroccan Sultanate. You see, Moulay Abdelaziz had been raised in the insulated comfort of the court. And what was special about this court is it was dazzled by European, quote-unquote, modernity. As a young man, European diplomats were presenting him with gadgets he grew so intrigued and impressed with. Photographic cameras, bicycles, telegraphs, gadgets our guy mistook for governance. Moulay Abdelaziz was in some sense a man out of sync with his surroundings. He did not lack ideas per se, but he envisioned a future for Morocco that Morocco had not signed up for yet. And he clearly had his priorities all over the place. In a time of mounting European hard power, he introduced Moroccan society, at least in the big cities where the authority of the mkhzin was recognized, to the bicycle, the telephone, photography. He dreamt of reforming the army, making it more centralized, a more disciplined force. And like many dreams, these dreams needed funds. So Moulay Abdelaziz imposed new taxes, financial tools he saw as necessary for a modern state. And naturally, this infuriated the tribes who saw these taxes as yet another attempt to squeeze them from the center. And it's not like he was all the more popular in the cities. Urbans were making fun of him for looking like someone who played Sultan in a European costume, as he certainly did not shy away from bringing European dignitaries into Moroccan court life. Quite early on, he surrounded himself with foreign advisors who had a huge influence on his decision-making, therefore giving them floor to place their bets on Morocco and to defend their own country's respective interests. They were feeding him blueprints of progress imported from Paris or London, and Moulay Abdelaziz was eating it up. Saying he was naive or soft doesn't cut it. He was completely numb to what was unraveling around him, detached from the real pulse of the society he was in charge of ruling. What he made of his father's rule and of Bahmed's regency was a facade. And without Bahmed's hand holding it together, cracks quickly turned into holes. That is when the center began to give way. That is when things started to fall apart.
One of the biggest cracks was financial. By the early 1900s, Morocco was basically out of money. The state couldn't pay its troops, manage its affairs, or keep control beyond a few strongholds. In 1904, as an attempt to stay afloat, essentially, Moulay Abdelaziz signed a punishing loan deal with French and British banks, putting Morocco's customs revenues up as collateral. That same year, the Act of Algeciras was signed. It claimed to respect Morocco's independence, but in reality, it handed over Morocco's finances and police rights to European powers, mostly France, with Spain playing a supporting role. They called it a reform, but no one's fault here. It was not. It was colonization, but just done slowly and dressed up to look like help. Meanwhile, the countryside was coming apart. Tribal uprisings were breaking out in different regions. Again, the Rif in the north, the Sous, Atlas al-Mutawassit, these zones that had always lived on the edge of state control. Now they were in open revolt. Al-Mkhzin, the central government, could not even collect taxes from these villages without sending in troops. And it is in the middle of this chaos that another character stepped in. His name, Moulay Abdelhafid. Abdelaziz's older brother, the nominal governor of Marrakesh. The thing with him was he spoke about things that Moulay Abdelaziz had absolutely no sense of: dignity, tradition, independence, a language the people wanted to hear. Where Moulay Abdelaziz seemed weak, Abdelhafid presented himself as the opposite: rooted, strong, and ready to take the country back. In 1907, he made his move. From Marrakesh, he called for jihad against foreign interference and declared himself the rightful sultan of Morocco. He had dynastic legitimacy, which comes with religious legitimacy, and so his cry rallied different powerful tribes, especially in the south, as well as religious leaders, especially those that were linked to Sufi networks like Al-Darqawiya and Al-Tijaniya, which carried real weight across the entire country. His message was blunt, but boy was it effective. Moulay Abdelaziz had handed Morocco over to the Christians. The country didn't need a sultan who played with cameras and bicycles, toys like a grown-ass kid stuck in Wonderland, but it needed someone who would fight, who would defend Morocco's faith and independence. A mujahid, an adult. And for a population that felt angry, humiliated, frustrated, and tired of watching their sovereignty slip away, that message hit home. Can you blame them? Around the same time, the French had made their first real move on the ground. In 1907, a French doctor and engineer named Mauchamp was killed in Marrakesh by a crowd angry at the growing European presence. France did not waste the opportunity, like it never does. I mean, we know them by now. They used this incident as an excuse to bombard Dar El Bayda, Casablanca, in August. Then they decided to move in and to occupy the city, allegedly to restore order, quote unquote. But let's be honest, it had never been about that. It was about one thing though: control. The masks were starting to slip. From there, things spiraled, and they spiraled fast. The Sultanate of Morocco was now in the middle of two brothers, Abdelaziz on one side, Abdelhafid on the other. The question back then seemed to be, who would define Morocco's future? But in retrospect, for us today, a century later, we know the real stakes, the real tension lied in the following one. Whose signature would the infamous Treaty of Fès, signed in 1912, bear? Who was gonna officially hand over Morocco to Europe? Who would be remembered as Morocco's traitor? With that question left in the open, Al-Hafidhiya had begun. By 1907, Morocco was not a real state anymore. It was a country that was being pulled apart, both from within and from the outside. Two sultans were claiming the throne, Abdelaziz in Fez, holding on to his European advisors or whatever, and the promise of modernization. In Marrakesh, on the other hand, Moulay Abdelhafid was serving religious legitimacy and the language of resistance. Let's not get it twisted, we know today that that dynamic had nothing to do with some sort of romantic rebellion for national liberation. Not close. Moulay Abdelhafid was reaching for power with both hands, for himself. But in the Morocco of that moment,
Power could not come wrapped in the language of reform or of secular ambition like it could in Europe. It absolutely had to come with a sacred accent to it. So, as most rulers did in Moroccan history, he presented himself as the defender of the faith, the protector of Islam, the rightful heir to the tradition of sultans who had stood firm against the unbelievers. Good Lord. His speeches were mixing personal ambition with verses from the Quran. His calls to arms were framed as jihad, and so naturally people who were mostly Muslim were sensitive to it. But the truth was more complicated, as it always is. His army marched on Fez with weapons he bought using foreign gold, money that had nothing to do with resistance and everything to do with strategy. All while he was going from place to place, delivering the most fiery sermons about fighting off Dalin, the infidels, sermons that could literally make a believer cry, he was also meeting quietly with the same European consuls he condemned. What can I say? As much as I'm not fond of this guy, he understood the game. To win over the people, he had to look like the defender of their faith, like their ally. But to actually take power though, he had to make deals, sometimes with the very powers he claimed to be resisting. And if, by any chance, something started ringing in your head and it sounded familiar, what I just said, then it hit the nerve it had to. The internal war that was Al-Hafidhiyah played out in a very messy way. Instead of having defined battles with defined troops, the matter was more settled with shifting alliances, bribes placed at the right time with the right people, betrayals at the right moment, and carefully timed declarations of bay'ah, the oath of allegiance taken by tribes to a Moroccan sultan. If we were to analyze it, the real strength of Mulay Abdel Hafid came from two things, two pillars of support he could fully rely on. One, the religious establishment, especially the ulama and the powerful zawaya that we talked about in previous episodes. And two, southern tribes, particularly those from the Sousse and Dra regions. Meanwhile, Fez, with Mulay Abdel Aziz hiding inside, was growing more and more isolated. His support base in the cities that were once the heart of his power was fading fast. People there had grown completely disillusioned. They were done fighting for a palace that now looked little more than a puppet court, tied to foreign advisors and bound by humiliating treaties. By 1908, the support of Mulay Abdel Aziz had become reduced to a few coastal cities and some military units that were trained by foreign forces, and that were honestly more show than they were strength. Even in those cities, respect for him had reduced considerably, if not completely vanished. Meanwhile, just a few kilometers away from these cities who were turning the Sultan into a joke, the French army was shelling Moroccan villages. The contrast could not have been sharper. And the final act of humiliation for the administration of Mulay Abdel Aziz came in August 1908, when he decided to make a public move to secure French support, ladies and gentlemen, once and for all. He officially accepted French decorations and the financial backing they had been offering him, hoping it would stabilize somehow his position, but it ended up having the opposite effect entirely. The little legitimacy he had still managed to hold on to during the Civil War disappeared overnight because, contrary to what he thought, Moroccans, especially in the rural and religious classes, did not believe he just aligned himself with the foreigners and nothing more. In their eyes, he had ultimately submitted to them. That was it. Mulay Abdel Aziz had crossed a line and there was no going back. From a failed sultan, he had made himself a traitor. Whatever moral ground he had left, the moment he took French money and French honors, French everything, he lost it. His name began disappearing from khutba in mosques around the entire country, signifying that religious leaders were clearly no longer recognizing his authority. In key urban zones, his oath of allegiance, his bay'ah, was being publicly revoked, one city after the other. And by the end of the year, Mulay Abdel Aziz had no choice but to flee Fez. With the passage being cleared on January the 8th, 1909, Muley Abdelhafid entered Fes glowing with victory. The rituals of power went off for him. Sermons praised him as the Imam, the commander of the faithful. The people of Fes took him in as their savior, or at least that was the image that was carefully staged. His bay'ah was carried out everywhere. The ulama, the religious elites, gathered at Al-Qarawin to give their blessing, and tribal leaders were lining up to pledge their loyalty. Some, not all of them. On the surface, it looked like a new beginning, promising a return to tradition, to dignity, to independence. But beneath all this ceremony, the contradictions were already popping up. The cracks were there. Muley Abdelhafid had built his claim on a promise of jihad against foreign domination, and yet the path to his victory had been marked by his silence during the French bombing of Dar al-Bayda, Casablanca, which we'll talk about in more details in upcoming episodes. But in reality, during his entire quote-unquote campaign for jihad, he had had quiet talks with European envoys where a tacit deal was sealed. Morocco could have a new sultan, sure, as long as nothing else really changed. The direction of the country, which had been slowly drifting into foreign control in the background of Al-Hafidhiyya, wasn't up for negotiation. It would be European. So that is where we'll leave it for today. Muley Abdelhafid entering Fes like a savior, draped in rhetoric, really, because that's all it was. The promises that were made, the faith people placed in him, and the way it all began to unravel almost immediately as soon as he sat on that throne. We're gonna take our time with that part of the story in the upcoming episodes, where I'll take you through what Morocco became slowly, painfully, in the years Muley Abdelhafid ruled. Quote unquote. So, if you're still with me, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please leave a 5-star review if you did. It really helps the podcast. Share it with anyone, whether that is a fellow Moroccan or someone who's curious about history in general. You can find all my short formats on Instagram, handle @yashukri. And in the meantime, keep digging.